Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is mixer Nacho Molino. First of all, I don't know if you've noticed, I'm sure you have, that music's shelf life is getting shorter and shorter. It used to be if there was a hit, it would stay with us 6 months to a year. We'd play it all over. You'd hear it everywhere. You go to a party, you'd be playing. But now, that's not the case. A current hit might last, an extended news cycle. Maybe that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not far from it. There's a lot of reasons for this. First of all, the barrier to entry is very, very low for any artist today. So we're flooded with all sorts of music that we never had before. That gives us a lot of different variables and a lot of different things to choose from. We're also distracted by multiple choices in things to do. And as a result, it's harder for artists to get any real traction. Even if you have a hit, you might only last about 3 years in terms of the length of your career. It turns out that when we used to purchase music, we listened to it more. We had a financial and a personal investment in it that we just don't have today in streaming. So maybe that's the biggest reason of all why music has such a short lifespan these days. But then again, the attention spans are shorter because there's a lot more choices and we're all multitasking. And music sometimes is just used as content marketing. Yes, it's true that by the time you hit 30, the fan base drifts away naturally because there's a focus on career and family, and the young kids coming in just can't relate to that music, even though it's only a generation old. So we're finding that this is happening sooner and sooner. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but it's just another evolution in music that we have to deal with. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my music mixing primer and 101 mixing tricks programs that will help take your mixes to the next level. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Now, if you ever tried to mix on headphones, you know it can be difficult. The mixes always come out different. And among the reasons why is that everything sounds overly wide in phones. Sometimes it seems like the center is missing. And mono sounds seem like they're coming from inside your head rather than in the center. There's also an unnatural frequency response that many headphones infer. So why is this? Well, it turns out when we're listening to a set of stereo speakers, there's a natural crosstalk between the speakers. There's also a spectral difference of our head, and that means our head is actually changing the frequency response depending on how we aim it. So none of this happens when we're using headphones. As a result, it really changes our mix. Now, there are new ways to actually get around this. Waves has Abbey Road Studio 3 and Ocean Way plugins, which I think are really good. I especially like Abbey Road Studio 3. Of course, there's SonarWorks, and there's plenty of other ones that are out there. But these also cost a fair amount to implement. There's also something that you can try that's a whole lot cheaper. It's called Can Opener from a company called Goodhertz. And what this does is actually create the crossfeed between speakers in your headphones, and you can control that amount. You can also control the angle of it, as well as many other parameters, in order to get a more realistic playback setting within your headphones. Now, between all of these, because you can, in fact, use Abbey Road Studio 3 or SonarWorks with Can Opener, you find that you put them all together and suddenly, yes, it is possible to mix in headphones. And not only that, it's possible to get a really good mix as well. So we're seeing a lot of advancements that are happening, especially in the last few years, on finally getting to the point where we can feel comfortable mixing on headphones. That was never the case before. My guest is five-time Grammy-winning mixer Nacho Molino, whose work with Ruben Blades, Carlos Vives, C.J. Ramone, Jean-Manuel Serrat, and many, many more. Even though he comes from a rock background, Nacho has been awarded Latin Grammys for Best Salsa Album and Album of the Year, as well as Recording of the Year and Best Tropical Latin Album. During the interview, we spoke about bringing a rock sensibility to mixing salsa, the strict rhythms of salsa, using audiophile speakers for mixing, common mixing problems that he runs into, and much more. I spoke with Nacho via Zoom from his home in upstate New York. Let's go back to the beginning. Tell me how you get into the business. You started in live sound first, right?
Yeah. I came out of high school. I was already, you know, playing in bands, especially punk bands. I was doing some home recording because I had a four track, but I really wanted to learn. So I started calling all the live sound companies that I could find, and one of them gave me a job. So I started, you know, the same as everyone, carrying speakers all over the place, and then worked myself up into actually getting to, you know, use the mixer.
Well, how did you make the jump then to the studio?
Well, that was what I always wanted to do, actually, being in the studio instead of doing live sound, although I still do live sound. Then after a while of working in the live sound company, when I kind of felt myself a little more comfortable with all the knobs and talking to musicians and monitoring and all those, then I started looking for a job in the studio. And I found a studio at the time. It was called Pork Chop Studios. And I got to work in that one. I didn't stop working on the live sound side of things. But then, you know, in the studio, everything is so more refined in terms of audio when it comes to it. So I started taking, actually noticing so much stuff with, like, you know, miking techniques and mixing. And then I would take all of that back to the live situation, and I would be improving, you know, both things at the same time.
Where was this at?
Panama.
You know, that's a place I want to go to.
Really?
I've been wanting to go there for a long time because I hear it's a lot of people really love it.
Yeah, the thing with Panama is that you have basically everything except for snow. You have everything. You have mountains, you have jungle, you have beaches, like anything you can imagine. And you can go from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean in like less than an hour.
I love it. Yeah.
It's very nice.
You were in Panama, you're doing all of this, and the studio was in Panama too?
Yes, in Panama City, yes.
Okay. And you got a break then working on a record, kind of promoted your career, right?
Yeah, I worked really, 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 really hard, actually, until I was finally able to open my own place. I had a partner at the beginning, and we opened a studio that was called PTY Studios. And PTY is the code for the airport. When you see PTY on a briefcase, it's Panama City. So actually, my ex-business partner came up with that one. And we opened that one in 2005. And we started, you know, I started getting really, really getting my own clients at that time. And the studio started in an apartment of a building. So I would drive everybody nuts during the day while we're recording drums.
I bet.
Because it wasn't isolated at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, drums or electric guitars, because, you know, they have to be quite loud.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that, I think after a year being there, we moved the studio into a house, and we did a, you know, proper isolation and acoustics and everything. And then that's kind of where everything started, actually, you know, getting the ball rolling with working with more important artists.
Were they coming because of you or your studio?
Well, I think it was a combination of things, because at the time when we moved to the house, there was another engineer friend of mine who we still work together sometimes. He was working with us in the, at the studio, and he had his clients and I had my clients, but we both were just, you know, working very hard to have everything sounding the best as possible. So people would, yes, they would come to the studio for the name of the studio, but then they, you know, depending on what they heard on the like outside, like they would decide who to work with. So you could say it was because of the studio's name at that time.
What kind of music were you doing mostly?
Well, it, this is a very interesting answer, because Panama's music scene is very small. So you cannot niche down in one or two genres. So you basically have to be good at whatever is thrown to you in order to make a living. You know, actually, it's funny, because when you think about Latin America, you would think, you know, Latin music like salsa and stuff like that. I didn't actually start working in salsa until probably 2007 or 2008. So I already had like 10 years of doing live sound and recording to before I got into the first salsa recording that I had in my life. But mostly it was either rock, rock pop, metal. Yeah, then salsa came in, and then there was a there was kind of like a huge wave of salsa orchestras coming to the studio to record.
You know, it's very similar to my friend Benny Facchione.
Okay.
You know Benny, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And he's one of my oldest friends. Benny had his first hit, big hits with Maná. And of course, that's as rock as you can get. And then it wasn't until later where he was exposed to all sorts of other Latin music, which, you know, now he records all of that all the time. But it wasn't the case for a long time. So it was very similar to what you went through.
Yeah. And also, I am actually, like, my favorite kind of music is metal. Like, my favorite band is Pantera. But my, let's put it this way, like, my biggest achievements have all been with Latin music, meaning mostly salsa.
Now, do you think that's because you brought a different sensibility to recording or mixing it?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with salsa is that I find it very much like metal or rock. Because like when you hear the trumpets or the trombones or the whole brass section, it's like having very distorted guitars just, you know, pushing a huge chord, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there, and then in salsa, you also have the, well, the cowbell, actually, which is the handbell, which is marking the downbeat when it's the second part of the song. And that kind of makes me, always makes me kind of like headbang a little bit, you know? So, and you have so much percussion, and basically it's like mixing a whole bunch of toms, because all of them are drums that you need the attack for the intelligibility, and then you need the note for the actual timbre of the, of the, of the drum, right?
Mm-hmm.
And basically congas are like the main element of the percussion. It would be the it would be like, it would be like drums.
Mm-hmm.
If it was rock or metal. And then the bass has to be tight with the congas, which would be, you know, kind of like the bass usually goes tight with the kick drum.
Yeah.
Only that congas don't go that low, but it has to kind of be like that for, in order for a mix to work.
Okay. Do you approach the bass differently?
I wouldn't know, because honestly, I've never seen, I mean, I never got to assist anybody in a studio, and I never got to be at like I don't know, another salsa album recording or mixing session being worked by anybody else. So I just kind of try to figure it out by my own. Also, I mean, I of course I had help from the album producers that I was working with, and then I've learned how to understand salsa because of everything they have told me and taught me. But I wouldn't really know if I treat the bass differently from other people, because I've never seen anybody else do it.
How long did it take you to kind of learn, you know, the basics of salsa?
Well, it took me a while, because it's a very strict formula, actually. Because salsa is based off the clave.
Yeah.
And the clave, in its simplest form, it can only be two ways. It can be 3-2, or it can be 2-3, which is actually two measures. You just invert them, right? Mm-hmm. So even though the clave has a tempo, meaning that it can follow a metronome, its accents are not linear like a metronome. They're non-linear.
Yeah.
So all the patterns for the percussion are already kind of like premeditated. So you just follow that, and whatever you do extra on top of that are usually the fills. But also, all the brass arrangement is based on the clave, with the accents of the clave, right?
Yeah.
And the clave of the song actually gets like the arrangers figure out the clave because of the rhythmic of the melody of the song. Then they decide if it's 3-2 or 2-3. There are some songs that can fit any of the two, and then they decide which one feels better with the song. And then they write the whole arrangement.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was very different for me, because in rock and metal, you have 1-2-3-4,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
over and over. In salsa, you have ba 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 ba. So it's not linear.
Yeah.
And everything is based off those accents. And then that's how you kind of like start understanding how the rhythm patterns of each instrument actually plays with each other.
Interesting.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, it is. So when you're putting everything together, then when you're layering it, how do you approach like effects? I'm thinking more like reverbs and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that usually depends on the producer of the album, because some of them like a lot of reverb. Like in the 90s, you would hear lots of reverb on salsa, and lately not so much. So that basically depends on the arranger. Usually, for what I would call the older style of reverb, I usually have to get my lexicon out, because the plugins they still can't reproduce that kind of like feeling of depth in the music, in my opinion.
Interesting. So like a 480 or 224 you're using?
No, I'm using a PCM 91 right now.
Okay. Well,
I had a PCM 70, which I sold before coming to the States, and I profoundly regret it.
Yeah.
So I might get one again.
Yeah.
But I'm just relying on my PCM 91 right now.
No, that's a good unit. And PCM 70 had a sound though.
Yeah.
Distinctly different.
It was noisy in the sense that it made a lot of hiss, but if you kind of like gain structured it a certain way, you could have the noise floor very low.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I always remember having like one of the mastering engineers I usually use back then when Spotify only accepted 16-bit files, he would tell me he wouldn't even dither the signal because of all the noise that the lexicon had on the noise floor, you know?
Yeah. Wouldn't have to. Yeah, right. It was there already. Yeah,
that's right.
Let's just talk about mixing. Is that what you're doing mostly these days, just mixing?
Yeah. I've been mixing and only mixing since I moved to the States. I moved to the States about 2 years ago, 2 years and a couple months. And yeah, that's what I've been doing. And I love mixing, actually. I've always wanted to just mix.
Yeah.
So I finally got to do it.
Are you totally in the box, or is it, do you have a hybrid setup?
It's a hybrid setup, but it's more in the box than hybrid, actually, because the only thing that I'm doing outside of the box is the summing. And I have an SSO compressor for the bus compression, and that's it. I just go back into the computer. If I need anything extra on the master fader, it'll be in Pro Tools. It won't be analog.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything I use is plugins. So everything's processed before coming out to the summing, unless I'm dealing with the salsa that needs the hardware reverb, then I'll just insert that one somewhere.
What kind of monitors are you using?
I'm using actually what would be mastering speakers or hi-fi speakers, better said. I'm using Eggleston Works.
Oh, boy. High end.
Yeah, but I love these. I got these from a mastering engineer, also a friend of mine. He was getting obviously bigger ones than these.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I bought them from him because he gave me a good price and I could, you know, pay little by little. So I bought them and I love them.
What I always liked about those types of speakers, audiophile style speakers, was that they just sounded big. It never sounded loud. It just got big and bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it has a lot to do with the amplifier also, but the thing with these speakers is that as long as you have a good chain going into them, you can really, really pinpoint very small changes.
Yeah.
Well, like kind of like what mastering needs to do, you know, because mastering is very, very subtle, actually.
Yeah.
But having this kind of detail with the mixing lets me work a lot faster because I don't have to second guess too much, I would say.
Yeah.
Since it's a full range system, then I'm not, you know, I don't have any doubts with the low end or how big or how small is it going to sound or how open or whatever. It's just there all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And ever since I got these, I feel like my when I print the mixes, most of the mixes are basically at the same level without me doing anything.
Hmm.
I will have a lot of variation before these speakers. It's not because of gain staging. I don't know what it is, because I always keep my mixing volume for the monitor controller, I always keep it the same. But with these ones, it's always the same, kind of like the same volume, same kind of like you would say the same color, because it's the same mixer using the same chains, right?
Yeah.
But it's like if I mixed an album with five different artists, the mastering engineer would have a lot of fun because he wouldn't have to actually match each song to each other.
Yeah.
Because it would be matched from the mixing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy how they make me work, actually.
What amplifier are you using?
Well, I'm using a Mitek amplifier.
Okay.
Mitek has an amplifier called Brooklyn amplifier. It's a Class D amp, and I know for some people in the hi-fi or audiophile community, some of them would say Class D is like a capital sin or something.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you something. This one works the way it should. I tried other brands of amplifiers, meaning Class A or Class AB, and this one just, you know, this one was just way better.
It's funny, when you get that combination right, you know right away.
Yeah, because it just, you know, with the other amplifiers, everything would be very pristine and clear, but it would be too pretty.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because the other amplifiers have so much, you know, they either have huge transformers and all these things that actually round off the sound. And this one doesn't.
Yeah.
This one just, you know, puts it out the way it goes in, basically. So I, with this amplifier, I can actually feel the music more than with the other ones. Of course, Class A or Class AB amplifiers will give you more depth than a Class D amplifier, but this one has enough depth, like way more depth than other Class D amplifiers I've heard. In fact, like if you watch a movie here in my system, let's say one of those Netflix series that have, they have like a lot of like ambience effects and, you know, like huge depth into the stereo image, like you can actually hear it like very deep, you know?
Yeah.
So it's very good.
I bet. Wow. Do you have favorite plugins that you tend to use in every mix?
Yes. I have a lot of, let's say, associations with some companies. Like I'm a Waves artist. I use also Sonimus plugins, which are, I don't know if you know them.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. IK Multimedia and Isotope.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But like all my go-tos are, for example, on the channels themselves, I will either have the SSL E channel, the old one, or the mix hub, the one from Chris Lorology.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I love SSL mixers. So I feel kind of like at home with those, although they don't sound exactly the same as an SSL, because actually no plugin actually sounds exactly like the real thing. But I feel very comfortable with those two. So depending on what I want to do, I'll just change for either one. And from Sonimus, I like using the latest EQ they put out, which is a Pultec-based EQ called Sun EQ 2. I use that on my master bus all the time. Sometimes I'll use the Satsun for some console saturation, depending on how it was recorded or what it needs.
Mm-hmm.
From IK Multimedia, I'm usually using the SSL bus compressor when I cannot get the real one to do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And from Isotope, obviously I'm using Ozone.
Yeah.
All of them. That's under my master fader, and obviously RX too, because, you know, sometimes you get like noises and stuff like that, and everything RX just works.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a second. Are the tracks that you get in, do you see a problem that keeps on coming up over and over that you get with the sessions that you get to mix?
Yeah. There are various common things that are happening. Most people think if they buy a very affordable interface, and if they send that recording to a pro mixing engineer, then they will have a very, very, very good sounding album. But people are always forgetting that the sound of it always starts at the source.
Mm.
And that's the common issue that I'm finding. Meaning good musicians, good instruments, and very well played. Microphones are different colors. So you pick and choose whatever you want, but you need that musician and that instrument.
Yeah.
In a fairly decent room. It doesn't have to be a $2 million studio in order to get something good. You just have to move things around until you figure it out and it sounds good, right? But also, the thing is, very affordable interfaces, they sound like very affordable interfaces, right?
Yeah.
So if you record something at home with very affordable gear, right, you cannot expect it to sound like it was recorded in a $2 million studio with very expensive gear, right? If you have the right groove, right,
yeah,
then it will always feel great, but the sound is not going to be the same. That's something that people are not used to separate from each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And then that's what I'm actually finding the most. And obviously arrangement is a huge part of it.
Yeah.
Because some people, like I find sometimes that they record, for example, electric guitars, and then they layer acoustic guitars on top of it, and then an organ, and then a pad, and they're all playing in the same octave.
Yeah. Same register. Yeah, right. No, that's a problem.
Yeah, and then they obviously want everything to be heard, but the thing is, like, we're occupying the same space with everything. So you're only going to be able to hear a couple of those things, but not all of them. So those are the things that I'm finding the most, which is people are not paying enough attention to the recording stage and the arrangement.
Yeah, I've always found that myself, where the arrangement is, and especially now when you have as many tracks as you want at your disposal, and there's always a lot of ideas. Well, let's try this. Well, let me try this one. Okay, let's try this. And next thing you know, you have all of these tracks that are basically playing in the same range, as you say, in the same register. And it's like, well, and then they'll send them all to you and say, well, yeah, you figure it out. And I was like, no, wait, that's your job. It's your job. You figure that out and send me one.
Yeah. And the thing is, I mean, I understand why they would think like that, because I used to think like that a long time ago. And that's something I think people with time, they learn that it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, the thing is, they will send you, you know, a kick, a voice, guitar, keyboard, shakers, tambourine, you know, everything in the intro of the song, when you only need the kick drum, one guitar, and the lead vocal in the intro. And the intro is amazing with those, only those three things.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right.
And they're, you know, it's, you know what it could be? Like, people are not, people are just trying stuff out, and they probably do not have the song in their head, the arrangement in their head.
Yeah. A lot of it has to do with experience, and so much more. Well, like when I was starting, everybody played in bands and you played in clubs before you moved anywhere else, and you got a lot of experience working on cover songs, but that would teach you how songs are put together. So yep. Then when you started to work on your own, you had an idea of how it all worked, and it just became second nature. And now when you don't have that, then people are experimenting and they're reinventing the wheel a lot on that.
Yeah, plus there's so many people making music and they're not really musicians.
Yeah, yeah, right.
That has nothing bad. There's nothing wrong with that. Anybody should be able to make music, but like, if you're a doctor, you study, you know.
Yeah.
If you're gonna be a lawyer, you study to be a lawyer. If you're gonna be an architect, you study to be an architect. So if you want to be a producer or a musician, you have to study music.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you go to college or if you do it by yourself or if you watch YouTube or whatever from, you know, reasonable sources. Right.
Yeah.
But people just grab a computer and whatever software, I don't want to name names, and they just start doing stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And that's fine. But you have to get to a place where you actually, you know, if you want to get really serious into it, you should study how to put music together.
Yeah. Right. Right.
You know, it's like, okay, if I always say the problem with music is that if there's a bad song, nobody dies.
You're right.
if you wrongly operate a patient in the hospital, the patient will mostly die.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
You know? So those are things, I mean, of course it is not as dramatic as it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
As operating someone. Or doing surgery on someone.
Do you have a favorite mixing technique?
What do you refer with mixing technique?
Like parallel processing, or, you know, you always use certain plugins on the mix bus and, or compress things or a certain way, or is there a certain trick that you use all the time?
Well, a parallel compression has been something that I've never been able to get it right.
Okay.
Yes. I'm still trying, because I find that, like, mixes that have parallel compression, I like them. I just haven't been able to get it right by myself.
Yeah.
But one thing that I do is I EQ into compression all the time.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I do not like EQing after compression. I will usually compress something before EQing it, but the EQ will be before the compressor and the chain. So let's say we have a voice, right? I'll get the compressor going, and then I'll EQ into the compression. That's something that I always do. I usually never EQ and then compress. I always compress and then EQ, but the EQ is before.
Most people do it the other way around, but, you know, whatever works.
I think it's a thing of, like, I learned on analog, and, you know, analog EQs, they're flexible. If you crank them, they won't, you know, they will have like a limit to itself. So when you keep cranking whatever you're cranking, it kind of compresses itself a little bit or saturates a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I think that's where that comes from, because if you grab a digital EQ and then you just crank it, it'll crank all the way up.
Yeah.
You know? So that's probably why I do it that way mostly.
Last question, Nacho. What's the best piece of business advice that you learned along the way, or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Ooh, okay. I actually have a couple.
Okay.
Yeah, one is get a good night's sleep, because with a good night's sleep, you will be patient and you will resist all of the crazy stuff that this business will throw at you. And the other one is, this is a business, right?
Yeah.
For example, me, I'm here to make a living. I love music and I feel music, but this is a business. And yes, it is a business that involves art and that it has its own magic, but it is a business. So people have to think about it as a business. And I'm talking mostly about artists. Artists get involved into the feeling part of it and to the magic and everything. But when it comes to the business side of things, they don't draw the line where you have to start thinking business-wise. Mm. I'm talking about when you have to actually get your music out there. I'm not talking about doing music to sell out.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking about you made what you've done. It's ready to release. Then start thinking business, because that's actually when you could say, I mean, somebody will think another way, but that's when business actually starts.
Yeah, right. After you have a product.
Yeah. And it's the same thing as selling, I don't know, soap bar. Hmm. You need to distribute it. You need to put it in the stores. You need to market it so people know that the soap that you made actually exists.
Yeah.
And then people have to like it in order for other people to buy it. It is the same thing. People have to start thinking business-wise at some point. That's the only two real pieces of advice here.
You can find out more about Nacho at nachomolino.com. That's NachoMolino, all one word, nachomolino.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find an Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.